Good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And tonight we have an author, William Whitecloud, who has written a really enjoyable book called The Magician's Way, What It Really Takes to Find Your Treasure. And this is a fictional book, although written in a way, I guess, similar to Celestine Prophecies and other books of the like, where it gives you a lot of tips and techniques to, I guess, to find your way, to become the magician, to create the life that you're really wanting to create. So I'm really excited to have you. We've been chatting through email for quite a while now. So welcome, William.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks for bringing me to the world, and wonderful to talk in person at last. Of course, yeah, it's been a while in the development.
In the making, yeah.
In the making.
So, usually I ask, you know, what was your journey in this? But I think the first question I want to ask is maybe, you know, how much of Mark Vail is William Whitecloud?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, because a lot of people automatically assume that that's my story and my journey, and it's actually not. Mark Vail, if you read the book and find Mark Vail's personality type, it's not my personality type, and It's not exactly my journey, although what is similar is that, you know, I have been on a journey myself, and Mark Vail's journey is one from, I would say a kind of unconscious ignorance of what his life is really about, to a discovery of what his life and life generally is about. And in that sense, it's very similar. That's been my journey as well.
Okay, so how have you gotten to where you are now? What has been your major themes, or more your, you know, part of how you are where you are and wrote this book?
Well, I grew up in a country called Swaziland, a country in Africa, and when I was born and in my earliest years, it was a very wild and remote place. I mean, if you can try and imagine this, the road to the country, the road to Swaziland ran out 100 miles before the country. So you can just imagine how wild and remote it was. And I grew up in a very isolated area, and it was like a real Garden of Eden, surrounded by all kinds of animals and wildlife. And particularly the world view of the people that I was around, the Swazi people, which is a very sort of spiritual, metaphysical world view, where everything has a spirit, everything has a meaning, everything has a purpose, that the material, physical reality is not as substantial a reality as what lies behind it. And then being transplanted and dislocated and sent to boarding school, to a colonial missionary style boarding school, where everything I had bonded with and identified with was made wrong. And although when you're 8 years old, you don't psychoanalyze these things, it's just in retrospect that I realized that, you know, I was very out of place and sort of very confused and didn't know how to fit in, and you know, the sort of Western style mindset that I was trying to fit into didn't really serve me, make much sense. And so although I struggled with it through high school and into my, you know, early working years and my marriage, the early years of my first marriage, you know, I soon hit a brick wall where I had an existential crisis and just really broke down and became, you know, I had terrible substance abuse problems. My marriage broke down. I lost all my money. I became homeless. I became very ill, to the point where I was really, you know, on my deathbed, basically. And how I know that was because I was receiving, you know, deathbed counseling. And I had a remarkable experience where I was doing everything I could, and doctors were doing everything that they could, and an alternative and complementary healthcare professionals were all doing what they could to save me, basically, and nothing was working, and I had this really weird experience of remarkable experience, really, of meeting someone who suggested to me in my last days of desperation that I should abandon all medical all medical avenues and take his prescription, which was to start eating meat and smoking cigarettes and drinking wine and having coffee with my meals in moderation. And this was his prescription, which I followed. And remarkably, I bounced back very quickly to life. And it made an enormous impression on me, as you can imagine. And the thing that I got from that was not that there was any efficacy in meat or wine or cigarettes or coffee, which I don't consume to this day, or that there was something wrong with Western medicine or complementary medicine or anything like that. The massive impression that it made on me was that there was something to do with the way I thought, that the way I focused, the way I paid attention, that determined what was happening to me, because I was very focused and desperately focused on staying alive and getting well, and yet I just continued to go downhill. And then when I just let that all go and abandoned it and you know, just indulged myself in substances that basically every single person that I saw, health professional I saw, agreed on. They didn't agree on much, but the one thing they agreed on was that I was a very careful diet, no nicotine, no alcohol, caffeine. These were anathema to that system. And yet in indulging in them and just letting go, somehow I came back to life, and it was, no one could explain it, I couldn't explain it. The only explanation that I was left with that you know, was branded in my brain was this notion, that this idea that it must be something to do with my focus. And so that compelled me on a quest. I didn't realize that there was anyone else in the world that had this awareness that somehow your focus creates your reality. And I thought I'd stumbled across something totally new. And so I determined to go on a quest to understand how this dynamic worked, and, you know, very quickly was led to the philosophies that I've been subscribing to really for the last 20 years and working with and teaching, which are very much based on alchemy, Neoplatonic and Hermetic philosophy, which really the basis of, I would say, is that your imagination creates your reality depending on the input, and that you can influence what is created by, you know, being the determinant of the input that goes into your imagination or subconscious or whatever you want to call it, you know, whatever your terminology is. And so that's really been my journey, Laurie.
Wow. It's almost like you, through your focus and the indulgences, it's just that you gave yourself permission to enjoy, but still were present in your body.
Yeah, you know, exactly. All of this I realized in retrospect, of course. As I went through my life, I couldn't have analyzed it at all. I had no idea or ability or technique for any kind of self-awareness. So it's all in retrospect that I see this. But in retrospect, what I realize about my illness, you see, is that it just started with a flu-like symptom, just like a cold. And I went to see a doctor, and then it got a bit worse, and, you know, I went to see a few more doctors, and soon I was seeing specialists, and was just getting worse, and I was going downhill. And what I realized, you know, what strikes me now looking back is just how much power I put in the professionals outside of me. All the hope and all the expectation was on authority outside of myself, and there was no power in me, none whatsoever. And I think it just relates back to my childhood, where I just ended up in boarding school and under, you know, a very authoritarian system, and just looked, you know, I was just trained to look to authority for everything, and never in myself for direction or power or anything. And so, you know, just totally projected my power onto authority, onto the medical authorities. And, you know, just looking back, I just see how all the power went out there, and there was absolutely no power in me. And the power in me just shrank and shrank and shrank, but projected out and out. And so there was a corresponding experience of that, of where my power, you know, physical power and energetic power and everything, just drained and drained and drained, and left my immune system, you know, run down and defenseless. And it's just fascinating stuff how our minds work, how our creative aspects anyway work. To me, I'm absolutely intrigued. You know, even if I have problems in life, I'm just always fascinated by the dynamics that create them. I can't help but, you know, just be intrigued and fascinated even by my own dilemmas.
It is an interesting experience that we come here to co-create and somehow find a way to enjoy. Okay, so let's talk about your book. It certainly has, you know, a series of paradigm shifts. We begin it with a story where the character Mark Vail, you know, has a childhood experience which basically created the template for his childhood consistent experience of picking things up, thinking that they were one thing, only to be shocked at how different they turned out to be. And so that started with the mole snake. Now, being from where you came, did this influence part of your story at all?
Are you asking, did where I come from influence that part of the story?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it did. You see, it did influence in two ways, in that's been my experience. And if there is any similarity between me and Mark Vail, then that's what it is okay. That... the thing that's always staggered me in my life, and I don't necessarily think that this has to be true of everyone else, but it's just my own experience, is that I have always been taken aback and staggered by how things are not what they seem, that when I go into anything, just how differently things just always turn out to be, that, just as I say, things are not what they seem. Mm-hmm. There's always much more to anything than one imagines, you know, once one starts getting into them. And it's something I enjoy. It's part of my enjoyment of life, is the unfolding of the real reality behind what we just perceive it to be. And also the experience that happens at the beginning of the book, which we, you know, don't want to give too much away, I guess, but he gets bitten by a snake, and that didn't actually happen to me, but I took it from my father's experience. That experience actually happened to my father when I was a little boy, and so I just used that. I thought it would be really, you know, powerful way, powerful story, powerful way to begin the book, and you use it as a vehicle to convey this shock of thinking you're picking up one thing and only to realize what it really is, and the consequences of that discrepancy.
Mm-hmm. And it's a great example. I don't know what a mole snake is, but I get the idea for sure.
Well, a mole snake's just a little snake that lives underground. That's why it's called a mole snake, mm-hmm. I guess, because it lives underground, burrows underground, and lives just beneath the surface in under debris and whatever. And also, it's blind, and it has a unique feature. Its unique feature is that, as a protection device that has evolved over time, it has two heads. It has a false head on its tail that actually looks more like the real head than the head does. So, you know, some animal striking it would strike at that head and, you know, protect it in some way. However, there is another type of snake that looks very much like it. A mole snake is harmless. There is another snake that looks very much like it that is deadly poisonous, though, you know.
So yeah.
You've got to be careful.
Apparently.
Yeah. Be careful what you pick up.
Mm-hmm. Or in this case, be careful what you wish for.
Sorry, what's that?
I said in this case, be careful what you wish for, because that was his wish.
Yeah. Careful what you visualize or wish for. Exactly.
Uh-huh. Okay, so the one other part of the story that you said is true is the magic golf lesson, which you actually did experience with your friend Chris Berkway, with the the new golf paradigm. Talk a little bit about that, because that certainly also moves this book in its journey, and it helps with the secrets. But I guess your experience. What was that like?
Well, yeah, the first chapter actually is based on a real experience that I had, and in fact it compelled me to write the book, because I had just set out to write a book because I train people over a extended period of time. I run long term trainings, and they're very in depth, and I prescribe different textbooks for people to read, and although they're very informative, they're also very dry, and many people find them difficult to read and sort of boring, basically. So I thought I've got to write something that's more interesting, and I did set out to write a textbook because I had no sense of myself being a writer. I've never studied writing, and I'm not, you know, I don't consider myself very highly educated, and as I say, I haven't written anything before, not trained in writing, so I wasn't adventurous. I just thought I'd write a textbook that was very pertinent to my curriculum, and I just thought I'm sure there must be a way of making it a little bit more interesting. And I started with an introduction to the book. I had nothing written at all or planned or mapped out. But I had this experience. I went for a golf lesson with a friend of mine. And it was just such a remarkable experience, because my friend Chris Berkway teaches golf in a totally unique way, where he gets you to forget about and let go everything you ever taught about golf, every technique and process that you ever learned about golf, which is very astonishing, because I think golf is most probably, if you know anything about golf, it's the most process-orientated undertaking in life. I mean, there is nothing more process-orientated and technique-driven. It's all about the technique. And Chris's whole approach is that when you focused in the technique, you're not focused on actually what you want to achieve, and therefore don't achieve what you want to achieve as well as you could. And so his technique or process is to get you to forget about technique and process and solely focus on what you want to achieve, to the point where he blindfolds you and gets you to hit balls just imagining where you want them to go. And it's just, you know, you can't describe it to people. Because of my book, thousands of people have been to see him for this lesson here in Australia, and people even fly in from overseas. And every one of them are blown away. It is just absolutely remarkable how we all have a natural ability that can just create sheer magic just by giving it a picture, you know, and then handing it over. And the result of this, because I hated golf. I was so frustrated by it that I'd even given it up. And to be there hitting golf balls with remarkable accuracy and precision and effect, blindfolded, was not only just remarkable, it was an absolute thrill, because I could really, it was probably the first time I felt my inner ability and creative nature inside me at work, to a point that I felt like I was on fire. And I went home very inspired, and I thought I'd write an introduction to my book, even though I hadn't begun it or mapped it out created a structure for it or anything. I thought, well, this, you know, I've got the introduction. And so I started writing the introduction, and it just felt so story-like, and I just felt some kind of, well, intuitively, that this wasn't about me. It was about another character having this lesson, and that they would have some kind of story that would unfold the principles that I wanted to convey. And so I just let it go. I went with it, and without any plans or idea of where I was going to go with this, I just let it come out of me sentence by sentence. I remember the furthest ahead I ever got of myself was about three paragraphs, which was, you know, very far ahead of myself compared to where I was most of the book. It just unraveled, and then reached a conclusion, and it was complete. And it was not only that, but I'd kind of come up with some new concepts that I wouldn't have ever considered writing about, and what I would have thought I would have written about, I didn't write about, but it just came out what it was, and it was perfect. And another remarkable thing about it was, because I was using the very technique that, you know, I teach people anyway, and that Chris had really reinforced to me, one of the remarkable things about it was that not only did I write this book in this way, but that I actually wrote it while I was undertaking an 11-month chemotherapy treatment or course. And so I was actually in a space of great debilitation and agony and pain and whatever. And yet, you know, because I was using this technique, the writing of the book actually embodies exactly what it teaches, really, or conveys.
Right. And so that whole vision or idea is that we focus on, you know, what we're trying to create and just accept that that will happen. But there's also a whole bunch of people out there that says, you know, we're supposed to enjoy the journey. We're not supposed to worry about the end. We're supposed to focus, because there's never going to be an end, and we're supposed to focus on the journey. So I know that they can connect together, but how?
Okay. Well, quite simply, this is that I agree with that, you know, and so people can get hung up in the paradoxes and then get very polarized in, no, you got to have goals and I'm going to have goals and there's no room for being open and or, you know, polarized with the other end of that, which is you just got to be open and goals aren't useful and whatever. So I myself like to resolve the paradox and say that they're both correct, you see. The thing is, as the Magic Golf Lesson demonstrates very powerfully, is that I agree that life is a mystery and it's a journey to be enjoyed, and I love the mystery of my life. However, where this all can be reconciled is that in all my experience and everything I know is that our creative nature is, however, engaged by end results. So, therefore, it's important to have end results. Whatever end results are true for you, there's no prescription or blanket prescription or formula that you can give people and say, this is what you're supposed to have as an end result in your life. It's just whatever it is for you. But if you want to be a creator live life very creatively and enjoy the joy and benefits of your creative nature going to work for you, you got to feed it. You got to keep it alive, as it were. You got to give it its petrol. And its petrol is end results. So that you got to have, well, you don't got to have, but it's beautiful to have, and it's inspiring to have, and it's useful to have end results, whatever they are, because it's end results that engage your creative nature. Your creative nature is engaged by end results. So you have end results, and you have the joy of creating, but at the same time, you don't have to put all the power in that. In those end results, they're not the be all and end all. You still live in a way that, or you can still live in a way that you're open to the highest in possibility in your life coming to you spontaneously, and that you aren't directing your life to the point that you're controlling it. I think if you have a balance of these two attitudes, from all my experience and the experience of everyone that I know that lives this way and that I teach, it adds up to a really beautiful experience of life where you do apply yourself in life and you do apply your creativity. Because it's just like this, Laurie, you could say, well, you know, look at a painter, look at anyone who's creative in an artistic way and say, well, you're not supposed to create, you're not supposed to paint. I mean, how could you take that away from a person who's obviously gifted as a painter and derives such, like my wife's a painter, how could I take painting away from her and say, oh, you're not supposed to paint? She paints and she loves painting and she's brilliant at it. She gets a lot of joy from it and gives other people a lot of joy. And yet at the same time, there's more to her than what she paints. But her creativity brings her a lot of joy. And for all of us, our creativity and our creative nature and our natural ability bring us enormous joy. And yet there's also a place for the mystery of life to lead us and guide us. I don't know if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So your first secret, which I find them really fascinating, but the first one is thoughts and feelings aren't real. And you go about, this is the thing that I thought was probably one of the most powerful things to me that you wrote about, just because it brought an aha moment, but you know that we tend to resolve our negative thoughts and feelings by doing one of three things, and that is giving up or retreating. which was what the character used to do, fighting, which I think a lot of people do, and I'm sure that there's been moments that I've done. But the one that I do the most, I think, would have been the third one, which is submitting. And
yeah.
I think it's really fascinating that we get caught up in, you know, it's kind of our way to detach. Like it's our alcohol, it's our addiction, it's the way, you know, we don't feel. So talk about that.
Sorry, the way we don't
feel, like it's our way of not really engaging in life.
By submitting or fighting or retreating.
Right.
Yeah. You see, the thing is with that, I get challenged on this, that our thoughts and feelings aren't real. And what that means really, let's look at what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that you don't think and that you don't feel, but what it means is that your thoughts and feelings are a perception. They create a reality and they create a perception. And thoughts and feelings actually don't really tell you very well what reality is. Thoughts and feelings tell you what you assume about reality. I have a technique where it's a very simple technique where when I'm teaching people about this, I just ask them to look at another person and then define that person as good and then as bad, or as powerless or powerful, or as in control or out of control, whatever, you know. We just change the definitions, and the thing that blows people away is how their whole perception of a person changes as they imagine the definition changing. They have emotional experiences corresponding to that definition, that the person's features change physically before their eyes. They experience internal changes. They experience external changes as the definition changes. And that demonstrates to them, should demonstrate to anyone, that reality is as we perceive it through our thoughts and feelings anyway, is just determined by the underlying definitions we're assuming unconsciously. So in that sense, thoughts and feelings express an arbitrary reality. They don't really express what's really there, or the true potential of the situation. So the thing is, I don't know about you, Laurie, but and certainly myself and everyone I've ever canvassed, no one can say that they were taught at school that your thoughts and feelings were, you know, just a representation of your unconscious beliefs or definitions.
Right.
In fact, the opposite. We actually collude as a society or as a race. We collude in giving thoughts and feelings power. We really put power into our thoughts and feelings. And so we really believe that thoughts and feelings, or we act as if thoughts and feelings are very real. So therefore, we're in reaction to thoughts and feelings all the time. And as you say, as you point out, we have generally a tendency, a set pattern to the way in which we react to our thoughts and feelings. And you know, as you say, some of us might flee, some of us may submit, and some of us may fight. And yet we are then, when we in reaction to those thoughts and feelings, we're a bit like Don Quixote charging at windmills and imagining that they're dragons. You see, we're not dealing with reality. We disengaged from reality, and you know, off fighting our own, charging our own windmills, as it were, and not there, present to the moment, present to the reality, and dealing with reality in an open, connected, functional way. I think what you said is what I get out of this is we disconnect thoughts and feelings. As long as we identify with them, they disconnect us from life. It's kind of like a disconnect, and we can be addicted to that disconnect for sure.
Mm-hmm. I think it's probably one of our major problems in our lives is that, you know, there's so many people out there that talk about, you know, detachment and how that's, you know, a high form of spiritual evolution. But I really, you know, there is a point where detachment can become part of that path. But unfortunately, I think we use the addiction of either our pain or, you know, our memories and how our memories reflect our pain, just as you talked about how it's our thoughts and feelings that really aren't real. So we get into our story and we, you know, we keep our story and we're addicted to our story. And but truly, we're not actually living our life because we're living it from a story. We're living it from our past.
Exactly. You know, I mean, that is a brilliant way to put it. It is absolutely a brilliant way to put it. And I actually put it that way sometimes myself, you know. And it's not just a way of putting it. It is the truth. It is our thoughts and feelings connect us to our story. And when we're in our thoughts and feelings and identified with them and reacting to them, we're in our story, you know. They are the manufacturers of our story. They are the petrol of our story, whatever way you want to look at it. Mm-hmm. You know, some people's stories are to detach, you know. There is a place for a kind of detachment in the sense of you know, just having your heart open and just being open to everything and not being too polarized with one thing or another. But there's also a way in which people detach, that they just remove themselves from everything and, you know, confuse that for a spiritual orientation when it's just another reaction to the story.
Yeah.
You know, that life can't be lived in, that life isn't here to live in. You know, that great Bob Marley song is Get Up, Stand Up, and he sings, you know, anybody says that heaven isn't here on earth doesn't know what life is really worth.
Hmm.
You know, to assume that life isn't here to be in and live in, I mean, I think is a tragedy.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's becoming more and more evident that that's the case. But I think it's just really fascinating because until you gave it those three areas, I mean, I think that you can put everything that we do into one of those three areas as a way of reacting. And we react from our story, but we do it in, you know, one of the three or all of the three, but predominantly one. And I thought it was really fascinating because it was a really great way of looking at how I do that, that I wasn't really aware of.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, you know, I'm a student of the Enneagram, which is a sort of a 9-pointed personality typing system. And when you look at it and you understand the system and you understand personality and you see the truth of that system in people's lives, it's very true, you know, that there are these personality types and that they do fall into three categories. That they're three groupings. So each of these three groupings have, you know, host three of the personality types, and it's very interesting because one of the groupings are emotionally based, one of the groupings are intellectually based, and one of the groupings are instinctively based, physically, if you will. And it's really interesting because the physical grouping are anger based and therefore fight based, and the intellectual group are intellectual group are fear-based and therefore flight-based, and the emotional group are the submissive group. It's very interesting.
Yeah, that's it. And I know the Enneagram, but I didn't know that information of it, so obviously I haven't learned it that well. But yeah.
Well, yeah, no, it's I've actually found, you know, that comes from several sources, that there is that, you know, grouping and origin, and, you know, it's probably not the subject of our discussion today. Maybe we could have another discussion
maybe.
On that, but it's fascinating stuff. It's absolutely fascinating stuff. And you know, the point is, though, is just how consistently these groups see, you know, actually see the world through their thoughts and feelings, and then how consistently they respond to it, you know, with absolute integrity. They, you know, generally they will always submit, or they will always flee, or they will always fight. And the point is that whether you're submitting, whether you're fleeing, or whether you're fighting, you're not dealing with reality in an appropriate way. You're not here, and you're not connected, and you're not creative.
Mm-hmm.
And so the task then, the challenge is to become aware of your program, really, and resist it. Is whatever you do, don't follow your program. And it's like when you're not in reaction, you kind of bring down you shut down those reactive faculties. You shut down the perceptions that they're based on, and you know, reality opens up into a different picture. And that's why, you see, I guess there's this strong theme in the book of how things are not what they seem to be, because they're not. And when you become present and resist your reactions, your reactive nature, and your reactive tendency in life, well you settle down, and when you settle down, a whole new world opens up that surprises you, you know, mm-hmm. and leads to not just seeing a different reality, but when, you know, we work in a way in life that we deal with the reality we see, and so it's obvious that if you in a situation and you have a preoccupation with seeing things as a threat, that you'll fight them. And if that preoccupation dies and you see it in another way where you see it constructively, see it for what it really is, and you might see, well, there is conflict, but here's the solution, well, you'll respond in relation to that solution. You'll act very differently. Eventually, you're going to have to take action based on your reality. The tension will resolve itself, and that's why people who try and control themselves eventually break down and you know, react worse than ever.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to react to the reality you see. So the thing isn't to try and change your behavior. It's to be more conscious of the real reality around you, because that will change your behavior. Because you only behave according, it's your behavior's response to your reality. You cannot help but respond according to how you see reality. It's actually impossible long term. So the thing is, you know, what I always see is people try and change their behavior, and you know, it's very much like trying to change the symptoms of some problem that you have. Like if you took an illness and that causes some symptoms, and you try and work on it at a symptomatic level, behavior is symptomatic, and you know, it's just not the thing to do. Really, it's not the creative thing to do, because it'll either come back in a much more perverted way, or it'll sublimate or something. the thing to do, you know, is to change the reality, really. And when the reality changes, of course, the behavior changes with it.
Right. Which is your second secret, which is your focus creates your reality.
Exactly.
And so when we focus on our reality, or when we change our focus to look at, you know, what is the cause, because that's what you're talking about, where most Western medicine is very symptom-based. They don't look at, you know, they just look at the effects. They don't look at the cause. So when you're looking at, you know, truly what is the cause, which is usually our story and why our story is being created, then we can change our reality if we start focusing on the right things. Or focusing,
Western medicine likes to cut things out. That's the answer. You know, Laurie, I do an interesting exercise. I did it last night at a talk I gave up in Brisbane. And I get people to ask each other to move a pen from their right hand to their left hand. And the person that's holding the pen must move the pen from their right hand to the left hand. But if they feel manipulated in any way, they mustn't move the pen. And hardly anyone ever moves the pen because they always feel manipulated. Uh-huh. You see, because we're not very good everyone can focus, but we're not very good on really knowing what to focus on.
That's
because, you know, when people get someone to try and move the pen, try and get someone to move the pen from their right hand to their left hand, they don't just look at the end result of what they want to happen, that the pen must just move from the right hand to the left hand. They go into automatically what conditions must exist for the pen to move. So some people, you know, we're talking about personalities before. Well, you know, the anger-based ones, the fight-based ones become very domineering and dominant. And so on, and the submissive types become very seductive and self-effacing and believe they've got to go into a non-threatening sort of space. And, you know, the intellectual types go into their heads, whatever. And where the energy is going is into the conditions that we believe have to exist, how we have to be, how the other person has to be, how the environment has to be. And so then there's no energy in what we want to actually happen. The energy is just in what we believe needs to exist, the conditions that believe need to exist. So there's two consequences of that, is that we're not given our natural ability, our imagination, subconscious, whatever you want to call it, whatever you terminology you use for your creative aspect, that's not being given a picture of the end result. It's being given a picture of the conditions that have to exist, which really then is derived, obviously, from your belief system. So your beliefs are being focused on, unwittingly, unconsciously, but the energy is actually going into your beliefs. So ultimately, really, what results is what, you know, is a resolution in favor of your beliefs rather than a resolution in favor of what you'd really love to actually happen as just a simple end result. And it goes back to our thoughts and feelings. Is our thoughts and feelings propel us into that dysfunctional orientation.
So how would you be clear about the end result? Just say, you know, I'd really love it if you moved the pen from your right hand to your left hand?
How would you be clear about that?
Yeah, how would you be clear?
Well, you just be clear. I mean, that's the objective and nothing else. And that's what I train people to do, is I just say to them, okay, now just look at the person's left hand and don't do anything else other than just see where you want the pen to go and tell them to move it. And it's, you know, there's no way you have to tell them. You just have to tell them. You just got to take action. There's no right way to take the action, but just take the action. But take the action always seeing the end result in mind. And it goes back to the magic golf lesson, which that teaches you very powerfully. You close your eyes and imagine where you want the ball to land, and then you just hit it. But the other way around, the conventional way of playing golf, is how you stand and putting all the power into how you stand, thinking about how your swing's going back, keeping your eye on the ball, this and that. And, you know, with golf, it's, as I said, it's the most process-orientated endeavor ever invented in life, because there's just so much intention on all these things that have to come together for everything to be the right way. But then you're just so focused on the conditions. There's no power in the end result. You're so tensed up and unfocused that you inevitably play a bad shot. And you know, that really brought it home to me. And it's just the same with the pen exercise. It's very instructional. You know, to make us realize that we got to be a bit more conscious in life, because that's all it takes, is just a bit more consciousness, is not to do things so automatically. Be spontaneous in your life, yeah, for sure, but in strategic terms in your life, just have a bit more consciousness, take a bit more time to ask yourself, what's really the end result here? If this condition existed, what would I have? Oh, okay, so that's what I want. So then I must focus on that rather than this condition. I think it's easy. I don't think it's too hard or mystical or mysterious. We've just got to be just a little more conscious and less automatic.
Right.
Less reactive.
Less reactive. So your third secret is everyone has a heart. And discovering that can be a challenge, because a lot of people confuse their heart with their head.
Yep. Exactly. You know, most people do.
Yeah.
You know, and really, the notion that everyone has a heart. Well, we all do have a heart, but what is the heart? You see, I think the heart. I'm told that the ancient Greeks used the heart, the term the heart, as a metaphor for the subconscious mind.
Mm.
So in one sense, that's the heart. It's a part of us that's more like the soul. Everything that is outside of our rational, linear, self-conscious mentality, you see. And so in one sense, that's the heart. But in the sense that I understand it, and I use it in the third secret of magic in the magician's way, is that your heart really is your true end result. It's who you truly are and what you're truly about and what you're truly here to express. And we all have wounds. You know, I just expressed to you at the beginning of the show quite obviously what my wound is, and it's different to other people's wounds, and there's different intensities and levels of intensity of wound, but we all have wounds, and our wounds form a personality and a personality type. And they compel us away from our true nature and purpose, and our wounds form our identity, and our identity tells us we're not safe as we are for who we naturally are and what we'd naturally love and what we'd naturally express and what we'd naturally create. So we must create something else. We must fit into some other mold and become that, which will never support us. We can never be supported by what we're not. Only what we are can ever support us. But this is the illusion that we live under. And so when I talk about a heart, that everyone has a heart, is everyone has a true nature, a true expression, and talents and gifts and abilities, real talents and gifts and abilities, often which they're totally unaware of, that support this true nature and purpose and expression. And so that's what I mean by that we have a heart. But it's so masked from us, it's so difficult to know that, because we have this very strong reality that's represented to us through thoughts and feelings of what our life's about and how we should be and what objectives are and you know, what the thing to be going for is and what we need and what we want. And when we try and stray from that, this part of us will sabotage us. You know, there's a psychologist called James Masterson who termed this kind of dynamic abandonment depression. And the term depression doesn't just refer to depression exclusively. It's kind of any debilitating emotion that when you abandon your egoic agenda, when you abandon your identity's orientation and begin moving off in favor of something higher, well, you're going to be tripped up by very heavy feelings that make you feel like, you know, there's going to be a bad consequence for heading in that direction. It's going to herd you back to your old identity's way of seeing things and behaving. There's this false agenda that we're on, that it's like there's this line in The Matrix, the movie The Matrix that I love, where the mentor says, there's a whole world that's been pulled over your eyes, like we pull the wool over someone's eyes or something, you know. But there's a world that's been pulled over your eyes by your identity that says, this is your life, this is what it's about, which is not. You have another life. You have a heart. And, it's masked, that true nature and purpose, which is the life that is going to sustain us really, is masked from us. So it causes a lot of suffering in life.
I agree. One of the last points I'd like to bring up, it looks like we're not going to be able to get to the whole seven secrets, which is fine, because then people have to buy your book. But one of the last points, and it comes around magic, which is, and it comes with this theme, but love is the power of magic. And going on with what we've been talking about, we all strive unconsciously to get back into our hearts. And I think, you know, what you definitely talk about in this book is, you know, remembering that magic and that peace in our hearts. And I think if we can, you know, strive to have that childhood innocence again, when we did believe in magic and we looked for fairies and we believed in Santa and we, you know, all of those things that made this world a different experience than when you're an adult. I mean, if we can recapture some of that and know that, you know, that does come from our heart, that, you know, we can learn to enjoy the life we have.
Yeah, I mean, the if you read the original story of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, it's very by Robert Mallory, Sir Robert Mallory, I think his name was, and it's very interesting because traditionally we all think of King Arthur as the most powerful person in the kingdom, and Lancelot. But really, in the original story of King Arthur, the most powerful knight in the land is Lancelot's son, Galahad, and his power is born of his innocence. And in fact, when he breaks up the Knights of the Round Table and sends them on the quest for the Holy Grail, because when the Knights of the Round Table behold his innocence, everything ends. The whole paradigm of the round table is shattered, and Arthur takes one look at him and says to the other knights, this is the end of the round table, because they know that this boys' club is finished, you know, because here is a power greater than any of them have ever had, and it's the true power, and it's what they all want, and it's what they go in search of, and it's his innocence, you see. And innocence is what you're talking about, you know, and it's opening up to innocence. Like, I like that word, because if you break it up, it says in no sense. It's outside of our traditional senses, outside of our thoughts and feelings. And you know, just allowing ourselves. People say to me, well, how do you break out of this then? And you know, well, but it actually isn't that powerful. It is powerful, but it's not more powerful than your heart. It's not more powerful than your natural ability. And you can invite your natural ability in. You can invite your soul back in. And you can invite it back in by focusing on and intending on going back to that innocence. Going back to that wonder of life, going back to that awe of life, and you know, making that your goal, making that your target, and it will. I mean, that's what happened to me. That's how I started out. I that's actually everything I've come to be and grown to be, and from that rubble that I arose out of, I it was because of that. Is I didn't know the way, I didn't know the how. But I knew what I wanted, and it was that awe, it was that innocence, it was that wonder, it was that joy. I didn't know how it was going to happen, but that's the picture I had in my mind. That's what I wanted. That's what I was inviting back into my life. And I've got to tell you, it rushed back into my life, and it'll rush back into anyone's life who is sincere that that's what they want. And they're not going to control how that's supposed to be and how that's, you know, what must exist in their life and what mustn't exist in their life. To have that vision and then allow yourself to receive it, and it will happen. It will be delivered.
Right. So it's much more the qualities that we're looking to achieve than it is actually... I don't know what the secret teaches, which is to focus on the big car and the big house and the, you know, having lots of money. And so it's more the quality, because when you can embrace...
Absolutely. I think, you know, there are fundamental choices in life and there are primary choices in life. And fundamental choices are choices that define an orientation in life, and primary choices are about things that you want. And... it's okay to choose things. There's nothing wrong with things. I love things. But the most important thing to be focused on is the fundamentals, and it's the quality of life.
Yeah.
The qualities. The quality of having, of being free. The quality of living your true nature and purpose. The quality of being healthy. The quality of being the predominant creative force in your life, or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's the foundation. You know, it's fine to furnish your house, Laurie, as you can imagine. It's there's nothing wrong with furniture, but you must have a house to put it in. You know,
absolutely.
And so your fundamental choices are your house, and your primary choices are your furniture. And you know, we must not confuse our furniture for our house. First comes the house, and that's how I see it.
Yeah, no, I think that's wonderful. Well, William, this has been truly a delight. I've very much enjoyed this. I hope to have you come back. We'll talk about something else, I'm sure. But tell people how they can get a hold of you.
Well, you know, the easiest way is to Google me, William Whitecloud. I have a website, www.williamwhitecloud.com, and that's how you can get hold of me. It's also how you can get hold of my book. There's a store, and the book is a click away.
Perfect. Okay. Well, I very much enjoyed
this. You know,
we've
got lots going on all the time, and there's always a teleseminar or something,
nice.
A free seminar or whatever that if people, if the good folks out there enjoyed what I had to say today, they can hear a bit more of.
Great. Perfect. Anything else?
No, that's it. I just really so enjoyed talking to you. You know, it's just you've kept it to what I'm, you know, most fundamentally passionate about, and so I've really enjoyed meeting you in person at last, and I've really enjoyed your show, and you've just got such a great show, and I know you're doing really great work with your whole intuitive coaching program, that, and I'd like to thank you and also just really honor you for what you're doing, Laurie.
Thank you. All right, so we're good, and we will be back next week. But thank you, William.
Thanks, Laurie.
Okay.